This season of A Cast of Kings has been brought to you courtesy of the paid members at DecodingTV.com. Over at DecodingTV.com and at the Decoding TV flagship podcast, we're going to be covering a bunch of great shows throughout the year. We're currently covering Andor, more on the way that we will announce on A Cast of Kings podcast and Decoding TV soon. But for this episode, I just want to give a hearty thank you to everyone at DecodingTV.com who has become a paid member and made A Cast of Kings happen. We really, really appreciate it.
Storm's End is a short flight from here.
You have Baratheon blood from your grandmother, Rhaenys.
And Lord Boros is an eternally proud man. You'll be honored to host a prince of the realm and his dragon.
I expect you will receive a very warm welcome.
Yes, Mother. Your grace.
And it was smooth sailing for the Targaryens from that point forward. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV recap podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. I am David Chen, and I have not read Fire and Blood, the book on which House of the Dragon is based.
And I'm Kim Renfro, and I have read Fire and Blood, the book upon which House of the Dragon is based.
Welcome to the podcast. Every week on A Cast of Kings, we recap, review, spoil, discuss this week's episode of House of the Dragon. This week, we'll be discussing Season 1, Episode 10, The Black Queen. You can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. And find us on Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube at acastofkings. Before we get going with today's episode, a bunch of announcements that I want to let people know about. This is obviously the Season 1 finale, so people might have questions about what's going to happen with the show, the podcast, afterwards. I've already announced this on previous weeks, but I just want to reiterate that the current plan is for this podcast feed to be quiet for most of the year, but Kim and I will be recording assorted bonus episodes as time goes on, and I fully intend to hit Kim up to do some potential show recaps with me over at the Decoding TV podcast, which you can find at podcast.decodingtv.com. So I would highly doubt this will be the final Kim and David Chen collaboration, and it might not even be the final David Chen Kim Renfro collaboration until the next season of House of the Dragon. On that note, everyone is saying probably we're minimum 2024 until we get the next season of House of the Dragon, which is very sad, but that seems to be kind of where it is right now. That there's probably going to be at least 18 months, so spring 2024 is the earliest we'll get the next season of House of the Dragon. Kim, is that roughly correct? Yes.
Yeah, I agree. I believe in some post-mortem interviews today, Ryan Condal, the showrunner and co-creator, said that that filming's supposed to start in 2023, like at the start of 2023. So yeah, with the typical production schedule for a show like this, spring 2024 sounds right for earliest possible premiere date.
I also want to mention, though, that Kim Renfro and I are going to be recording one post-mortem episode next week. So at some point in the next week or two, we will be publishing a post-mortem episode where we're going to be reading your emails as well as comments from decodingtv.com and just reacting to a lot of what's happened this season. Going to be pretty chill. It's going to be a fun time. We hope you will please stay subscribed to A Cast of Kings so you can check out that episode when it rolls around. But yeah, acastofkings.com is where you can subscribe. Also, youtube.com/acastofkings where you can subscribe to make sure you get that episode. And also email us. Let us know what your thoughts are, questions, stuff you wish we talked about more, stuff you wish we talked about less. I'm sure there's going to be nothing in that category at acastofkings@gmail.com. So shoot those emails to us. We'll be discussing them during our post-mortem episode. And the only other thing I want to mention is, yeah, I said this in the intro, but A Cast of Kings is part of the Decoding TV podcast network, which is my podcast network. And the Decoding TV main flagship podcast will be covering other shows throughout the year. Right now, we're covering Andor, and I'll have several more announcements literally in the next week about other shows we'll be covering that I think, if you're a listener, you'll probably be into. So try to keep it subscribed to the Decoding TV podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com as well. We'd greatly appreciate it. Okay, Kim. Follow-ups from last week's episode. Before we get to this week's episode, Season 1, Episode 10, let's talk about some stuff that happened last week that we did not potentially talk about or get right, even. In fact, you know, on a rare occasion, think of it like you're on a beach and you might find one grain of sand that's slightly different color than every other grain of sand. That's kind of what it's like to find an error on the Cast of Kings podcast. You know, that's how rare it is, given that you're hanging out with a Game of Thrones expert and some guy. there was a statement you made last week's episode, right? I think that turned out not to be accurate. You had said that the children cage fighting was not something that was mentioned in the books.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that was something that was in the books, correct? And I think you actually found the passage.
Yeah. So this is like, I do think I'm very good at reading comprehension. I've been hearing that since I was in like fourth grade.
Mm-hmm. I would say the same thing. Yes.
Thank you. but I read this passage in Fire and Blood and made an assumption about what it meant and then went with that. And then I was rightfully corrected. So yeah, in Fire and Blood, the passage where they're talking about the immediate aftermath of Viserys' death and the sort of like hunt to find Aegon somewhere so they could crown him. It says, quote, "The testimony of Mushroom claims Sir Criston found the young king to be drunk and naked in a flea-bottom rat pit where two gutter snipes with filed teeth were biting and tearing at each other for his amusement, whilst a girl who could not have been more than 12 pleasured his member with her mouth." End quote. Super exciting passage there. Yeah, obviously, like all of the like super unpleasant stuff that George R. R. Martin writes, I don't tend to dwell upon for like an excessive amount of time. But so anyways, when it says gutter snipes, I was like, oh, that's like an animal. Like I imagined like literal rats, or like the way that like cockfighting is a thing or whatever. Or like, I thought that was some word for some type of creature in Westeros, and that he was like watching animals fight while a 12-year-old gave him a blowjob, which is already quite a scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that if you look up the word gutter snipe, it literally means like dirty child. Like this was referencing the fact that he was watching two presumably orphaned children fight for pleasure. So was in the books, not in the whole elaborate, like, there's an entire institution built around this child cage fighting match situation. But yeah, I was wrong to say that that was an entirely show invention thing. It is alluded to in the books in one of the accounts of how they found him.
That's not a reading comprehension thing, though. That's more of a vocabulary. I would not have known what a gutter snipe is either.
I know,
off my head.
But rule number one is if you don't know what the word is, you go look it up. And in this case, I just like made an assumption about what that word was because I lacked the imagination to think that children were fighting each other for Aegon's pleasure. So yeah, that was indeed in the books.
If there's one thing we can encourage people to do is if you don't understand a word, look it up, aka what your kindergarten teacher taught you. So, or I guess elementary school. I don't know if people are reading quite, if they're using dictionaries in kindergarten. I don't remember. Anyway, point being, thank you for all the corrections. We try to get it right on every episode. Sometimes we miss the mark, but we always appreciate the corrections. It just shows that there's people who are harder core than you, Kim, reading the books and listening to this podcast, which is an honor and a privilege that we're reaching those people.
Indeed.
One last thing before we get to this week's episode of the podcast and also this House of the Dragon season one finale, which is that I just want to acknowledge Kim, as I've been doing both last week and this week. One last time, I'm going to put it all in this episode, so we don't even need to talk about it next episode. Okay, next episode, I'm not going to mention this. But 4 months ago or so, I reached out to Kim Renfro and I asked her to. I had a pretty wild pitch for her. I said, "Hey, I'm David Chen, a person who you barely knew and have never had a conversation with before in your entire life. I host a podcast that is relatively popular about Game of Thrones, and my beloved co-host, who everyone loved, and who was basically the main reason people listened to the podcast, has left to go to another podcast network. Are you interested to come join me to co-host A Cast of Kings with me? And by the way, we need to start recording immediately. I need to get you a new microphone. We need to just start doing this like right away. P.S. I'm going to put you in front of millions of people, and also you will get all of your work scrutinized in a way that you never have before. And Kim said, that sounds good. Sign me up. But in all seriousness, yeah, there. As I said last week, there was no assurance that A Cast of Kings would continue without the David Chen, Joanna Robinson team up. It is only because Kim Renfro said yes to me. That's why we've been able to do this show. And I am certainly grateful for it. I know many tens of thousands of people have benefited from hearing Kim's insights and learning from Kim this season. And so I just wanted to one last time this season acknowledge Kim's contributions and say that I'm incredibly grateful that she took a chance on this podcast and talking with me for the last 3 months about this show, especially with everything that happened with the last season of Game of Thrones and all the stuff that's happened since then, especially given that we'd never worked together before. There was a lot of unknowns going into the season of how it would be. At the end of this season of House of the Dragon and Cast of Kings, I am immensely proud of the work that we've done together, the podcast that we've put out together. It has been a dream collaboration, one of my favorite collaborations that I've ever done. So I just wanted to say thanks to Kim Renfro. And if you are out there listening to this and you feel you've benefited from Kim's knowledge, you should reach out via Twitter, via email at acastkings@gmail.com and thank Kim Renfro as well. But Kim, thanks. And how do you feel at the end of the season? You know, like, how does it feel? You know, based on where you thought we'd be at the beginning, you're now at the end. What do you think?
It feels great. And honestly, I credit a lot of that to you for this process. The end of Game of Thrones was tough for so many reasons. And then it feels like the world only got tougher from that point on, in much more serious ways. And yeah, it was a hard few years. And when you reached out about this, I was like, I felt like excited at the opportunity, but there was like, I was a little bit nervous. I didn't really know how it would go. I didn't know how the whole season would go. And you have just been phenomenal in like guiding me through how the podcasting process works, always being very encouraging, giving me great feedback about like my ideas and my thoughts, and just really helped give me a confidence that I that like sitting here now, season one finale, it's like I feel pretty chill and just like happy and excited to talk about it. Whereas with Game of Thrones, I was like, I was getting myself into a place where I was like, you know, couldn't eat for 24 hours because I was so nervous and like this pressure on myself for like trying to make sure that I was doing everything exactly correct. And I feel like I've been able to just sort of relax into like covering the season, trusting my own expertise, feeling confident about what we're doing. And that's been a really incredible gift. So thank you, David Chen, for giving that to me.
It's been an honor, and I have learned so much, and I have enjoyed this season so much more because of this podcast and because of you. So I'm going to miss it, honestly.
Yeah, me too.
During the off season.
But how exciting that we know we're coming back. And now we know what it'll feel like. You know, it's not 2 years of waiting in dread that like this spinoff thing might be a disaster that we have to analyze. It's like, I like that we are both having a lot of enjoyment, which means that hopefully that'll continue with seasons to come.
I would say House of the Dragon is a great show, in my opinion. It is a great show with, from my perspective, a lot of problems, you know, and you think probably fewer problems, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Many people agree with you.
And same with you, right?
Yeah. But it is a great show, and it's fun to talk about a great show on television.
It is.
I agree that there's a lot more knowns next time around. Our dynamic, I think, is much more well-known. I remember, like, when we first started, it was honestly pretty stiff, but that's just, like, very normal, you know?
Yeah, it's very normal. My little reporter neutral territory hat on. And I was like,
we are long past that now, Kim.
Wait, yeah, I'm now. Swearing.
But yeah, you know, Kim and I found our dynamic throughout the years, throughout the weeks, I should say.
It's felt like years.
And yeah, we probably won't come back until House of Dragon season two. Although who knows? Maybe it's possible this Jon Snow thing will be done by then. You know, maybe.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
Yeah, who knows? Anyway, thanks to Kim, and again, huge thanks to Decoding TV paid members who have helped to make the season of A Cast of Kings possible. All right, Kim, let's get into season one, episode 10 of House of the Dragon, entitled The Black Queen. I was like, which show are we covering again?
I thought you were about to say Hot D. One, get that in there one final time. Mm-hmm. Anyways, yes.
This episode was written by Ryan Condal. And let's talk about overall thoughts. What do you think of season one, episode 10, the season one finale?
I loved it. This is the most emotional I've gotten while watching an episode of House of the Dragon so far. I was like full on weeping through like most of the first 20 minutes up until Rhaenyra is crowned. I think that they've done a really, really good job of making me want her to succeed. And so having like her, like a Rhaenyra focused episode as the finale felt very satisfying to me for like an emotional endpoint. I thought that the entire final sequence with the dragons, like incredible set pieces, incredible visual effects work, incredible performances from every single person, like, you know, some little qualms here and there, but overall I just thought it was like a really, really solid finish to what has been a great season of television.
I would agree. I thought it was overall very strong. Reinforces a lot of the themes that have come out throughout the season.
Mm-hmm.
Could have used a little more childbirth, in my opinion, you know, looking back on season one. But other than that, no, I'm just joking.
One nice one.
Would have been nice to get one okay childbirth in the mix there. But, you know, whatever. You only have a limited number of episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I think any big issues I had with the episode are a result of my issues with how they chose to structure the show as a whole in general.
Yeah.
All the casting changes, all the time jumps this season. I was watching the LA Times was on my trending today, and the author really went in against this episode and saying that, like, because of the time jumps, because of the casting changes, like you basically feel like you have very little attachment to a lot of these characters. And I think that is true, especially with the kids. There is a moment in this episode where they're talking to Rhaenyra, who's in the process of giving birth. And they're like, you've done this five times before. And you have to like remind yourself, oh, right, she has five kids, like a couple of which we have spent some time with. And then like a couple that we've basically spent no time with.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, yeah, I got to remind myself of that. And so when, and we're obviously going to spoil season one, episode 10, but when Luke dies this episode,
mm-hmm.
I didn't really care that, you know, he's a very adorable child. And so like, I care that someone adorable has died. Like,
yeah.
I didn't like care in the sense of like, oh, I was deeply attached to this character. Right.
Right. Like
I cared because he was an adorable kid that died. And that's just like sad and painful to see in general.
Yeah.
And also because it reinforced this theme about how once conflict begins escalating, it can be very, very difficult to like rein it back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I ultimately liked about this episode, is like it really does do a good job of like speaking to the themes of the oppression inherent in a patriarchal society such as Westeros and the United States. And also kind of this idea that like conflict can often grow beyond your control, can escalate beyond your control,
mm-hmm.
can take on a life of its own, and can often result due to misunderstandings and things that weren't even intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Things that weren't intentional slights or intentional prophecies or what mm-hmm. have you. And those are themes that the show has been tackling throughout the season. And so these are not just like new themes that the show's bringing up. And so I really like that this episode kind of like tied it all up. So have some problems, again, with how the whole storytelling has been done this season, but as a season one finale, I thought it was very strong. Okay. Mm-hmm. You had some thoughts. You were going to respond.
Just when you were saying, like, because I agree that I was crying at the start of the episode, not the end of the episode, right? Like, mm-hmm. Luke's death was sad, but not like, it wasn't like watching Arya get killed at the end of season one, right? Like a character that we've like spent so much time with and that feels like a huge loss to us. Instead, it's like...
Arya?
Right. I'm like, as a hypothetical.
I see. Okay. I was like, did that happen? No.
No. I'm saying like, hypothetically, yeah. If one of the Stark kids were to have died
exactly.
That would be season one.
Shocking, right?
Yes.
It would be, yeah.
Incredibly shocking, incredibly emotional. Luke, right. Like they really did their best to give as much characterization to him in the start of the episode as possible with his like one-on-one chat with Rhaenyra. But yeah, I can totally see why like that wouldn't have landed.
It did land in a way, you know, it didn't right. land. It didn't like not land completely, but I think it didn't land. Like you said, like it didn't land like here's a character I know and love who's dying tragically. It's like, yeah. Here's just a character dying tragically.
Yeah.
Right. But it still works fundamentally as a piece of storytelling. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think that what has been so enriching about this podcast for me is, the kind of minor bummer for me as a show watcher is, this sounds weird to say almost, but like, it feels like this is definitely a show where it's a much more richer show if you've read the books. I know that's yeah. true of Game of Thrones as well, but like, it just feels way more true here. Like right from the opening credits, you know, all the way to all the time jumps this season. And the fact that what has happened in the show is frequently in dialogue
mm-hmm.
with how it was written in the books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just feels like for you, you're getting like multiple levels of goodness out of this. And I'm getting one level of goodness that's very good, you know?
Yeah.
But it's different. It feels very different than Game of Thrones because Game of Thrones, it's like, oh, they like compressed time or they combined characters into one, you know, for storytelling ease or whatever like that.
Mm-hmm.
But here it's like the show is almost like trying to make a statement.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of like why things were written in the book that way and why they were shown canonically in the show this way. And that's very interesting. And it's stuff that I only have access to through our conversations, right?
Yeah.
Like I don't have access to it as just a show watcher, not knowing anything about the books.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful to have our conversations, but I have kind of felt at a remove for a lot of the season, but I've still really enjoyed the process overall. So anyway. Those are kind of my overall thoughts
heading
into the finale.
Totally valid. A totally valid interpretation of like what the show is doing and what the effect is going to be depending on who their audience is, like who has read the books and who hasn't, who is absorbing all this exterior or external information versus who isn't. And like, that's a risk that they took, I think. And for some people it paid off and for some people it really didn't. And so that's the way the cookie crumbles.
I think there was just enough in the show to like, if you're just a show watcher, there's so many people that enjoy it just as a show.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that's impossible. What I do hope is they don't like lean too heavily in the we're accommodating only book reader stuff in season two. You know, like that I think might get very difficult to watch, but
mm-hmm.
I have no reason to think they'll do that. So I think they still are primarily making a show that just in House of the Dragon leans much more heavily on book knowledge than Game of Thrones did in the past.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break for our sponsors, and we'll be right back with more conversation about the season one finale of House of the Dragon. It's time to talk about one of our sponsors, Uncommon Goods. Your loved ones are complex, beautiful mysteries, but Uncommon Goods knows exactly what they want. Whether you're shopping for mom, dad, teenagers, in-laws, best friends, Uncommon Goods makes it easy to find remarkable and truly original gifts for anyone. Uncommon Goods wants your holiday season to be stress-free, so check out their selection of thousands of items today. When I go to uncommongoods.com, a bunch of stuff sticks out to me. A DIY mochi ice cream kit. That sounds not only a lot of fun, but delicious as well. A Starry Night Air Fort. My nephew has something just like this, where he loves crawling inside, looking up the stars. It's like his little home away from home. or home inside home, I guess you could call it. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. They have the most meaningful, out-of-the-ordinary gifts anywhere. Who knows what shopping will look like this season, and the unique gifts that Uncommon Goods can sell out fast. So shop now and get it taken care of early. I also love that if you don't want to just buy goods, you can also buy these things called Uncommon Experiences. Like, for instance, making authentic masala chai, organic spice kit included. Or make a vision board. Learn a powerful tool from manifesting your goals. These are experiences you can give at uncommongoods.com. And no matter what your friends or family are into, Uncommon Goods has the perfect gift. Art, jewelry, to kitchen, home and bar, Uncommon Goods has something for everyone. Not the same lackluster gifts you could find anywhere. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. With every purchase you make, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $2.5 million to date. So we've got a deal for you Cast Kings listeners. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/kings. That's uncommongoods.com/kings for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. All right, Kim Renfro, let's get back into House of the Dragon Season 1, Episode 10. So opening scene, Rhaenyra is talking to Luke in front of the painted table. What is going on here in this scene, Kim?
I think we're seeing, they basically pick right up with Rhaenyra and her family, presumably pretty shortly after they've arrived back to Dragonstone after the events of episode 8. So like the last conversation that they all had, or the last encounter that they all had with the Greens, was that family dinner. Aemon and Luke kind of having a little spat, where Aemon brought up, you know, his strong father again. And they've been brought back to Dragonstone to try and like calm down everything. And obviously that is a terrible approach to what's happening, because they don't know that in the meantime, Viserys has died. So we're picking up at this conversation of like Luke and Rhaenyra chatting about the fact that, well, like not talking about the fact that he's a bastard, but instead talking about his inheritance to Driftmark and how Viserys just reaffirmed that, and sort of like Luke's fears that he can't live up to his mother. I thought it was so sweet. It was really sweet to see like what the kids think about Rhaenyra, or at least what Luke thinks about Rhaenyra, and this idea that he sees her as like perfect. And Jen, you can see on her face that she's like, I'm very much anything but. But yeah, I thought it was a really good way, like knowing that Luke was going to die this opening of the episode, I was like, oh, this is starting to get painful now, of seeing just like the tenderness in their relationship, I thought was really sweet.
Yeah. Rhaenys arrives and she's carrying some pretty bad news. She explains, so first of all, they are expecting she will have news about Corlys, because we still don't know what's gone on with him.
Right.
And Rhaenys surprised them with the news that Viserys is dead, which is very sad and, you know, not shocking, but like, you know, it's sad when a sick family member passes away. Mm-hmm. But that is not the end of the bad news. She's like, I think she says something like, there's more, or is something like that. I'm like, yeah, there's definitely more. And then she explains the events that happened last episode. A couple things to observe here. I think Daemon is there during this scene, right?
Yeah.
And he immediately jumps to the conclusion that Viserys has been murdered, right? So, which is not an unreasonable conclusion.
It's not, but at the same time, like, he didn't look to be in great health the last time you saw him. Like, is it really, like, you're not even going to consider that he might have just died of natural causes, given...
Yeah.
But you're right, not unreasonable. In the book, there's like one of the rumors or the accounts is that poison was slipped into the drink, like that tea that he was always drinking for his pain. So
I do think that the show actually leaves open the question of whether that's the case or not. You know, I don't think the show definitively says one way or the other. It would be shocking to me if that was what the show is trying to say. But you do see Allison give him like this drink before he dies. So it's open to interpretation. But Rhaenys explains that Aegon has usurped the throne. And now it's on. Like, they need to start figuring out what their response is. So, yeah, any thoughts on this scene before we talk about the fourth and final childbirth scene that occurs in House of the Dragon Season 1?
There were just some cool like staging details that I noticed that I appreciated. Like when Rhaenys first enters the room, she like stops at the head of the table, gives the news that Viserys had died, and then she moves closer to Rhaenyra to tell her about the usurping. And you can watch the Kingsguard, who is there are multiple, there are at least two Kingsguard on Dragonstone because they're there to protect Rhaenyra, the heir to the Iron Throne. And you can watch the Kingsguard like keep pace with Rhaenys as she gets a little bit closer. And it was just like a cool reminder that like Rhaenyra is in this cloak of protection because she is thought to like, she is meant to be next in line to the Iron Throne. So I just love that little staging detail.
It's cool. I loved it. I could see the guy like following along with her in the background. And so that was nice. A lot of like Kingsguard lurking in the background this season out of focus in significant ways. So I appreciated that as well. At around the same time that she gets this news, Rhaenyra goes into labor. It's clear that it's very early. And Daemon starts to prepare for a fight. He starts taking control and so on. So we had kind of differing opinions on this whole sequence here. I mean, first of all, this is another childbirth scene. As I said, the fourth childbirth scene of out of four this season. I think I said this on a bonus episode at decodingtv.com. I'll reiterate it here on the main show, which is, I have been very appreciative of this show in showing some of the more raw, visceral, unpleasant elements of childbirth. And I do think that in a way, it, tell me if you agree with this or if I'm stretching way too far. I do think it is kind of like a pro-choice show in the sense that you see people making extremely difficult, challenging decisions about childbirth in the show. To quote a common leftist line about this, none of which would be improved if there was a person from the government telling you what you need to do in this situation. Right? These are incredibly like personal, challenging moments that I think the show depicts. And I think it's just good in general for society when we depict things more accurately or more well-rounded in a way that they aren't in other elements of society. Like, 99% of childbirth depictions are not nearly as painful or challenging as they are in this show, right?
Yeah.
This show has almost single-handedly trying to tip the balance in the other direction, right? Like, it, on its own, it is like putting forth so many childbirth depictions into the ether that are much more sort of, you see much more how difficult it is for the mother, that it can help to correct people's perception of what childbirth is. And so I really appreciate that. I do think it's a lot. It's a lot to handle. And we've gotten many emails from people saying like, hey, I really would have appreciated, like my wife is like 8 months pregnant. I really would have appreciated a trigger warning before watching this, you know, I had to like fast forward through this. But anyway, what were your thoughts on this particular childbirth scene? Obviously, it's very different from what's in the books. And do you feel like there was a purpose for yet another one of these scenes? And if so, what was it?
Yeah, I mean, I had guessed that they were going to do this childbirth in the finale because it is in the books that basically that Rhaenyra goes into labor prematurely, that like she's not due according to the maester's calculations for some time. And yet like the news of Viserys' death and that she's been usurped kind of kick her into labor prematurely. So I was expecting that. I was not expecting to feel so emotional as I watched her do it by herself, basically, like refusing help from her, like handmaid people who have been with her through multiple episodes. When I was rewatching the earlier season this weekend, it's like the same. I think her name is Alinda. It says in the subtitles is like one of her younger maids who's been helping her. Like seeing them get emotional, watching her be in pain and going through the stillbirth. The way that she calls Luke and Jace into the room, and the way like that shot of Luke, Jace, and Maester Gerardus all kind of watching her. I thought was incredibly powerful. And then feeling her, like I could feel so distinctly her pain at the fact that Daemon was not in that room with her and that Daemon wasn't checking on her, wasn't consulting with the maester. He was just out within earshot of her crying for him, like crying out his name or crying in pain, and he just like would not go to her. He obviously has his own whole hangups about childbirth, like the situation that happened with Lena, I think was supposed to be very hard on him, but he watched Lena basically choose to die this dragon's death, dragon rider's death, versus dying in her childbed. And like, so Daemon has no idea of knowing whether or not Rhaenyra is about to survive what she's going through. And the fact that he could not get himself to be there for her and instead was focused on the war, I thought was very impactful at just making me like triply empathize with Rhaenyra in that situation. I think that the show has been very deliberately showing, you know, this theme. Emma in the pilot episode tells Rhaenyra, like, the birthing bed is our battlefield. We have royal wombs, and the expectation is that we will pop out children as long as we can until we die, basically, or until there are enough heirs to have satisfied the kingdom. To start the finale with Rhaenyra enduring this incredible grief and physical pain and tragedy on top of her having to still deal with the fact that men try to assert control over situations where she should be the default person, right? Like, I could feel her getting frustrated. And then when she finally sends Jace back into the room where she's like, nothing should be happening without me saying so. If I am the queen, which I thought everybody was agreed upon that I am like the inheritor of this Iron Throne, then I should be calling the shots. And she can't control the fact that she's in labor at this very pivotal moment of time. And so I really think that that just did so much work to set up her emotional mindset as she finally assumes that mantle of queen and tries to decide how she wants to be a leader. I was crying throughout like most of it. I just really felt her grief. I was shocked by how many times they showed her baby.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting them to like really just put that little, it's a girl in the books. They explain, it would have been her first girl child. She's had all boys. Her first five children have been boys so far. I really, really felt that pain, and watching her like prepare the body herself instead of letting the seven, like the,
yeah, the Silent Sisters,
the Silent right? Sisters do it. There were so many, I rewatched it trying to analyze a little bit more why it was so impactful for me. And I think I came to the conclusion that like Daemon is not witnessing her pain, right? Like Daemon is choosing not to see her in that vulnerable, scared state. But so many other people do, like the fact that her sons and the maester and her servants and then now the Silent Sisters, all of these people, and Rhaenys, right? Like Rhaenys is there and sees the beginning of her labor and then sees the funeral. There are so many people just witnessing her pain and her grief. And that, I think, was very, very like affecting on me, because a lot of times when you're going through something like that, you just want people to be there and like let you know that they are there for you. So I thought it was beautiful. I thought it certainly warranted some sort of a trigger warning. I can't imagine someone else who's experienced a miscarriage or a stillbirth watching that. It was brutal. But I think in a way that was completely in line with what they've been doing the whole season of showing us the violence that women are made to endure because it's their duty versus the violence that men endure because they seek it out or because they start a war. Right.
Yes. I agree that the performance, Rhaenyra's performance was like amazing, as you know, and the way you describe, like, the camera really takes time to focus on other people's reaction to it, which I think we didn't really get with some of the other births. And that is powerful as well. I'm really glad it worked for you. And hearing you describe it just now is very powerful. It did not work for me on the level that you described, you know, and I don't need to go into detail because you did such an amazing job just now of like explaining why it was great. But for me, it didn't really work on that level because, a lot of people have said this idea of like, why wasn't Daemon there? And the issue with that for me is that, in my opinion, Daemon is behaving quite reasonably in that situation where there's people that literally might attack them at any second. Mm-hmm. And he's just trying to like prepare them for it. If that was not a factor, it would be very different for me, right? That like if Damon is avoiding being there and there's not people imminently about to like potentially kill them all, then I would feel very differently about it. But because it's happened with that timing, I don't know if it was this way in the books either, but like because it was this timing, it's like, oh, he's just trying to make sure they all don't die. I understand it's a super reasonable interpretation that like based on what the show has given you, that he's not there because he can't handle making another decision like he did with Lena or and you know, along those lines, or he just doesn't want to see Rhaenyra in pain. Like that's all reasonable to decide, but like for me it was not, it felt pretty muddled to me, this whole like Daemon Rhaenyra stuff that happened in the sequence. But
yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say I do think it's a lot of subtlety, which for me, those are the things that I pick up on a rewatch, or like once I know what's happening, then I'm really looking for the glances between people or the body language or whatever. And I do think that they could have been more explicit with what was going on with Damon in this episode. And instead, I was constantly kind of like looking for the clues as to like what was going on between him and Rhaenyra. And I think that it kind of stays consistent for the rest of the episode where he's like on edge the whole time, right? Like he bends the knee in my notes, not to jump ahead, but like when I was watching for the first time, my note reaction, as soon as he bent the knee and called her my queen, I was like, stay on that knee, Damon. Like, don't you dare like mess this up again. And he kind of does. And so I was like, yep, there.
Yeah, the Damon stuff this episode, again, I've already said what really worked well for me this episode, which is reinforcing the broader themes of the show and Rhaenyra in general, you know, like, and kind of this tragedy of the plot situation.
Yeah.
But Damon as a character doesn't really work for me this episode, unfortunately, just because there's so much time. We have fast forwarded past so much time that I don't know who this character is anymore. Like, yes, he bends the knee. Okay, that's actually shocking, you know, like to me that he would do that. Again, I told you in The Crown season one, in which Matt Smith appears basically playing the same character where he's like the husband to a woman who is queen. He is asked to literally bend the knee to Queen Elizabeth. And he has a great amount of difficulty with that because he's a man. And this is many decades ago. And that whole thing is very, very nuanced and beautifully done in the show, The Crown, in my opinion. And comparing it with this episode where it's like, okay, yes, there's a visceral power when Matt Smith, who has been such a badass earlier this season, like bends the knee. But as a character moment, I'm just like, what is that character thinking at that? Is he tortured doing this? Is he just completely accepting? Because later on, it seems like he might be a little tortured about it.
Yeah.
But we don't know. We don't have access to any of that because we have spent so little time with this character as he's gone through this journey from, you know, episode 5 to basically episode 6.
We also haven't seen him and Rhaenyra alone together. It's been mostly the two of them united against Alicent in a room, or united against someone else in a room, and kind of like giving off this team dynamic. And I do think the fact that we didn't have a good idea of how he treats Rhaenyra in private prior to this episode made it.
It's just all muddled. It's just so muddled. Like, am I supposed to be surprised that he bends the knee? Am I supposed to be not surprised? Am I supposed to be surprised when he chokes her or not surprised? You know, like, I don't know because I just don't know enough about their relationship personally.
Yeah.
But anyway, I have suspicions of what I'm supposed to be, you know, how I'm supposed to feel about it. But like, I just feel the Damon stuff just really didn't work for me throughout the whole episode, unfortunately. Many other things worked, and we'll talk about that. But let's talk about, you know, what happens after this brutal scene that you so eloquently described. There's a funeral for the baby. It's very beautifully done. They're on this like cliffside, and it looks like the same area where they got married, from what I could tell. The rock formations looked similar. I don't know if that might be completely something I made up, but
that would make more sense than them getting married on Driftmark, right? But they didn't really give us context for that marriage scene in that episode, that would make sense to me.
Yeah. So, yeah. you have some details about the baby, the name of the baby, and so on from the books, right? That isn't really described in the show.
Yeah, they don't even mention the sex of the child in the show, but in the book, it's explained that it was a girl and that Rhaenyra names her Visenya, which is the name Rhaenyra had picked out for Emma's baby in the pilot episode. Viserys and Emma have a conversation where Emma says that Rhaenyra is pretty sure it's a girl, and if it is, she wants her to be named Visenya, which is the name of one of Aegon the Conqueror's sister wives who also helped conquer Westeros. I don't know. It seems like they just didn't include that detail in the show, but bonus Easter egg for anybody watching if you want to feel extra sad about the dead baby, I guess. I'm like, it's not a very pleasant detail, yeah, but yeah. Yes.
Eric, hey, it's in the notes, Kim, so I want to honor your work by putting it on the show.
Thank
okay?
you.
So Eric with an E arrives from last episode. He's the guy who got all sick of Aegon's BS and is like, I'm going to go and do my own thing. And he arrives and he bends the knee to Rhaenyra and he brings a crown. And there's something important about this crown. It's not the same crown that Aegon had. What is the significant detail about this crown that he hands to Rhaenyra?
Yeah, so Eric basically secreted out Viserys' own crown. So this is the crown that King Viserys wore all throughout his reign. It's also the crown that Jaehaerys wore before Viserys. So this crown has a lot more symbolic significance to like the recent reign and line of succession of kings, which has been done in this new way with first the Great Council from Jaehaerys, and then Viserys obviously naming his firstborn daughter heir was a new thing. So it's almost like this crown that Rhaenyra is wearing is sort of like the symbol of recent Targaryen rule, whereas the crown that Alicent and Otto chose to place on Aegon's head belonged to Aegon the Conqueror. And I think it's pretty cool. Otto also like specifically mentions this like later on the bridge where he's like, he has the Conqueror's crown. He has the Conqueror's name. He was crowned in the dragon. Like, you know, like Otto was being very intentional with mantling Aegon in as much legitimacy as possible. I also think that Rhaenyra wearing her father's crown, the king who named her heir, is also a very powerful symbol. So this was like the end of my tears. Like I turned into like happy, almost crying I thought it was a really beautiful scene. Like
there's a shot where like Daemon's holding the crown and like he like puts it on her head.
Like he did with Viserys.
Yeah, right.
Like that was also kind of a surprising move from Daemon in episode 8 when like he's the one who helps Viserys up to the throne. Big development from where he came in the pilot episode. And then I agree with you that it's kind of confusing that seeming character development gets like wound back a bit when Daemon flips out, but we'll get to that
a little bit later. Yeah.
But the crowning scene I thought was beautiful. I love the fact that Rhaenys stayed standing and like nobody needed to remark upon it. You know, she's all the way in the back of the room. No one can see her, but she's the way that Rhaenys gets to witness this moment for Rhaenyra felt very powerful. So
I really like that Rhaenys at no point during the until she talks with Corlys, she does not bend the knee. She does not bow her head. It's very prominent that she does not do those things that everyone else is doing, which is very smart of her. You know, she's like, you can never say that Rhaenys is not doing what she's saying she's going to do, or you know, representing herself in the way that she's going to. She could have bowed and then took it back later, but she's not going to do that. So I like that about her.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, talk about some sponsors, and we'll be right back. It's time to talk about one of our sponsors, Mint Mobile. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by big wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I first heard that Mint Mobile offers premium wireless starting at $15 a month, I thought, what's the catch? But after talking to them and using their service, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they're the first company to sell wireless service online only. So they cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. I have used Mint Mobile before, and it is super easy to use, but it's also extremely affordable. I use the plan with a SIM card. They send you that SIM card, you put it in your phone, and you're off to the races. For anyone who hates their phone bill, Mint Mobile offers premium wireless for just $15 a month. They give you the best rate whether you're buying for one or a family. And at Mint, families start at just two lines. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan. Keep your same phone number, all your existing contacts. Again, it is a seamless transition. Switch to Mint Mobile and get premium wireless service starting at just $15 a month. So we got a deal for you folks to get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free. Go to mintmobile.com/kings. That's mintmobile.com/kings. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/kings, K-I-N-G-S. Thanks to Mint Mobile for sponsoring us today. We get to what is called the Black Council you have here in the notes, right? I don't think it's called, is it called the Black Council on the show?
Or is it just that? I don't know if they refer to it that way, but because they styled the previous episode the Green Council,
yeah.
And I'm 99% sure in the book they call it the Black Council. Because like now we can't say Small Council anymore because
yes.
There's two royalties.
Yes.
So I think from this point,
people confused, right?
Yeah, from this point forward, we'll do Black Council or Green Council.
There is a sequence where the table that they use gets lit up. I guess through they like light the thing that's underneath it, and then you see it start to illuminate from the center outwards. It is one of the most beautiful things that's ever been on the show. It's incredible work of, we've talked all season about how good the production design has been, how good the artistry behind some of the props has been.
Mm-hmm.
And this has definitely been a show that has lingered on those things in a way that I think provides honor to all the work that's been done on the show.
Yeah.
But this is an amazing piece of set dressing, you know, or probably that's not even the correct term for it, but like it's, you know, it's an amazing part of the set that is dynamic and amazing. So I loved it.
Yeah, gorgeous.
And here we see Rhaenyra really take charge. And Rhaenyra is, from my estimation, an inspiring leader
mm-hmm.
in this episode. Now, I sent you a comment that someone named Jason from one of the Slack groups I'm in had mm-hmm. made last night. I'm reading this without his permission, so hopefully he's okay with it. This amazing episode made me even more frustrated with some elements of the big time jump, mostly that the calm, strategic, wise, puts the realm first Rhaenyra we see here in this episode matches really well with the Millie Alcock version. So what the F was she doing in the 10 years between? Having sex with Harwin Strong and having his babies over and over, knowing it would endanger her claim to the throne and letting Alicent gain control of her father completely, it just doesn't match up at all. I'm very happy because this Rhaenyra is amazing and I'm ready for season two, but that will always be a pretty glaring oof from season one for me. I wasn't even thinking about this thing when I was watching this episode, but I was like, yes, this resonates with me that like the Rhaenyra we see in this episode is badass. You know, she's giving birth by herself. She is single-handedly preventing the kingdom from going to war. It doesn't super match up with kind of the image of Rhaenyra that we get in episode 6 when after the big time jump occurs. You had some strong thoughts about this when we texted about this last night, right, Kim?
Yeah, I mean, I think I just disagree that her having children with Harwin was some indication that she was like completely reckless and flouting her duty, et cetera, et cetera. Because doing that only endangered those children if people gave a crap. And King Viserys doesn't. Like, you can tell that he, for the last 10 years, has been protecting this possibility from being publicly discussed. Laenor doesn't care, her husband. In fact, Laenor seems to have fully endorsed the fact that she can have children with someone else, since he is unable to provide her with children. Corlys doesn't care. Like, all the people who like have a reason to give a crap that Rhaenyra has been having children out of wedlock don't really mind. Like, it seems to be an agreed upon thing that like this marriage happened, she needs to produce heirs, she can't do it with her husband, so either she would have to like dishonor the Velaryons by divorcing or somehow leaving Laenor and like remarry again, or she can like have children with this nice supportive knight dude who seems happy to just like chill in the background and not really make a fuss. And episode 6 is where we see that blow up in her face because Alicent and Kristen won't drop it, right? So like, I don't know, I think that Rhaenyra has been I think that they've done a pretty good job of building her up and showing some very impossible situations that she's put in, not by choice, but simply because she's a woman. Like all of the things that she did when she was a teenager or even in that episode six, whatever, nobody would have given a crap if she was a man, right? So I think like when people like...
I'm very sensitive to that perspective. Like I want to, whenever I say anything about Rhaenyra, I'm like, would I be saying this if she was a man? Like I want to like check myself whenever that's the case.
Yeah.
At the same time, I just disagree with what you're saying. Like I just feel like if she had not had children with Harwin Strong, like she would not be in the situation that she's in right now. In my opinion, right? Like you're saying, well, they just happen to care. Well, it's like, yes, but the Rhaenyra we see in this episode is someone that would account for that kind of risk, in my opinion. Like,
yeah,
all the decisions she makes, they don't work out, but all the decisions she makes in this episode seem really smart to me. She's like, we're not going to go off to war immediately. We're going to make sure we have the loyalty of all the people. You're going to like kind of offer, like send strongly worded emails to these people and make sure like they're still on our side. Like it's all very smart stuff.
Yeah.
But the idea that she would like, again, from my estimation, endanger her claim to the throne by having children out of wedlock with this other dude, in a way that was like obvious and lasted many years. And then also like allow Alicent to kind of gain control in the way that Alicent does.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't match with the version of her that we see here, which in my estimation is super badass in this, like she's awesome in this episode. But like from what I can tell, like she made very silly decisions earlier on that we don't see her make.
Right.
So anyway.
If I could wave a wand and have one more hour of House of the Dragon, I would want a pre-episode six episode that shows you more of Rhaenyra's relationship with Harwin. I think that that was like a little bit too short-lived for us to really get the impact of why it was meaningful to her to have that man in her life. So I don't disagree on all the points, but I think that I am less concerned with like, I don't know. It's like, I don't see it as like a huge, I don't even know what I'm saying. We can move on. I think we've both hashed out.
It all adds up to you. Yeah. It adds up to you. You know, it
adds
sense
up to
you,
me. Like, it's not adding up to everybody else. And that's totally fair because we have gone like lightning speed through 20 years of this woman's life.
Right. So, but anyway, I think I've summed up most of what Rhaenyra tries to get accomplished in this scene with the Black Council, which is she's trying to not go to war immediately. She's trying to shore up her alliances, and they're trying to like map out where their advantages lie on this big map table.
Mm-hmm.
Eric gets word that someone has arrived like with a green sigil, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we learn in the scene afterwards it's Otto. Now, here is an advantage of having these time jumps, right? Is we get to watch this scene take place with a very similar staging happen decades later. It's Daemon on the bridge. It's Otto confronting him on behalf of the crown. Rhaenyra showing up on a dragon. But the context is very different. And there's like a lovely parallelism to that. That you don't get if you don't have a time jump in one season. Now, you could have had it in season two or three that, you know, where you have that parallel, but whatever. Like, we got it all in season one, and I do think that's super cool that you get to have this kind of happen again, but in a kind of mirror image of what happens in, I think it was episode two or three, where two, we saw a similar dynamic play out. So, Otto shows up. He has, in my opinion, a pretty good deal. He's basically like, you can stay here, you can have Dragonstone, and your kids can be, you know, members of the court, and no one needs to die here. Daemon is not accepting of this at all, because in Daemon's mind, they have murdered his brother. So he's like, there's no way I'm going to let this. And also, the king is a terrible person. So it's like, there's no way this is going to stand. He's ready to literally murder Otto and all his men right there. But Rhaenyra reels him back. Otto presents Rhaenyra with a page that I guess it was Alicent that tore out of Rhaenyra's book, or vice versa, right?
Vice versa. Rhaenyra pulled it out of, tore it out of the book that Alicent was holding in the Godswood in the pilot episode.
And somehow Alicent got back at it, but she's kept it all these decades, right? Kim Renfro, can you remind us what the significance of that page was?
Yeah, so that was a book. It was like a history book. They were sort of, it was like they were giving each other, doing flashcards with their Westeros history in the Godswood in that scene. And that section of the book is discussing Nymeria, who is a former ruler, I think sort of like an idol for someone like Rhaenyra. Obviously in Game of Thrones, Arya Stark also has a big affinity for Nymeria, names her direwolf after her. And that in episode 3, after Alicent has already been married to Viserys for a while, and you're seeing the splintering of Alicent and Rhaenyra's relationship, Rhaenyra is like sitting in the Godswood again, having a singer like repeat basically the equivalent of putting a song on repeat on your boombox, but yes, for a bard in the Godswood. And that song was also about Nymeria. So I think it's just, they're really linking together all of like the early, tender, sweet, possibly romantic connections that Alicent and Rhaenyra had when they were younger. And Alicent is sort of like weaponizing that emotional connection by having her father give Rhaenyra this book of a, like this page out of a book, basically reminding her like, don't you remember when we all got along and it was fine and the patriarchy was solid? Let's go back to those times.
Well, the other thing that's significant is Otto doesn't even try to explain the whole deal with Alicent hearing the prophecy. He's not like, by the way, your dad recounted. He doesn't even, it's like he's saying the quiet part loud. He's like, hey, there's a dude on the throne now, so like that's what we're gonna go with, and you just have to be okay with it. You know, like there's no attempt to kind of soothe that entire thing. It's just, it's, he's a guy, so that's why we're doing it, and you know, that's it. So it's,
Because I don't think Daemon or Rhaenyra would buy for a second that
because it makes absolutely no sense.
Makes no sense.
To their credit, to their
and
credit,
because it's not true. That's not what happened.
It makes no sense, and it's not true. So why would they buy it? Of course. But you point out in the show notes that it is this thing where last time it was Rhaenyra that saved Otto from getting completely torched, right?
Yep.
And murdered there. Otto is now trying to be like, look, I'm trying to prevent you from getting killed this time. Right?
Yeah.
So she says, hey, we're not going to kill you right now. I'm going to think about your offer. Until
she
the
saves
next
his ass again from Daemon on that
fair, bridge. That's fair because he's about to kill. So you're right. She's saving his ass twice. You know, that's a very valid.
Yeah, sandwiched with one tiny moment of Otto being like, "We're giving you terms and not killing you yet." Wink, wink. I don't buy for a second that Otto wouldn't still try some shady stuff, or like Laris. Otto and Laris are now like in cahoots. Mm-hmm. We saw in last episode he was like, I don't see why my time with Alicent can't benefit you, other creepy man on this show.
That was a Laris impersonation just now. Yes,
yeah, sure, let's go with
okay
that.
So anyway, she says she's gonna think about it. I do just want to give a shout out to the previously on for this episode of House of the Dragon. Now, first of all, apparently there was a shot that was not in the show in the previous season, is my understanding, which is cool. There's a shot like going into Viserys's bed chamber that was not in the show, which is always cool when there's something in the previous season that wasn't actually in the show. Mm-hmm. But then they show this page getting ripped out in... and, you know, usually previously ons will spoil something that happens in the episode because it's like, oh, this is going to be important. But when they show the page being torn out, I'm like, I have no idea how that's going to come back into play. And of course, it does.
I wouldn't have
guessed
that.
It was a really good previously on that summed up the entire season of the show, basically. So shout out to the people who edit the previously on.
Nice.
Back to the Black Council. They're still arguing over whether to start a full war. And Daemon at one point lists all the dragons that are in play, right? Which is kind of cool because I'm like, oh, it's kind of nice to know how many dragons are. How many dragons do each side have at this point, Kim?
Daemon tallies it as 14, but that includes 3 wild ones.
Yeah,
so like
it's 14 like potential dragons they could have.
Yeah, 14 right? Potentially on, because he refers also, he calls it Dragon Mount, which I don't think we've discussed before, is like Dragonstone is basically built on a volcano, they say. And so Dragon Mount is like the big hill behind the castle, which is where all the dragons hang out and live and nap and spend their days. It's like the horse pasture. So yes, apparently there are three dragons on the Dragon Mount that have not been claimed by anyone. And then they have 11 if you include all the children and all the young dragons with the old ones.
Yeah.
And then Team Green has 3 by his track.
I do like that we talked in the show, in this podcast, about how dragons are basically the Westeros equivalent of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And you do get a sense of, like, if they did go to war with dragons, like, so many people would suffer and die and burn. Like, it would be like mutually assured destruction in a way. We also know that at the time of Game of Thrones, which happens about 150 years after the events of this episode, dragons are a distant memory. You know, like, people don't even believe dragons are around anymore. So yeah. my wife was saying, like, we probably have like 100 years tops for dragons to still be around. I think it's probably less than that. Like,
yeah,
I think it's probably like 50 years tops for dragons to be around, because you need them to be. So there's this kind of tragedy of this escalation. It feels very parallel to like nuclear escalation, where,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're like, hey, should we use the dragons or not? If we use them, everyone will die. And then, you know, that 50 to 100 years from now, there's no dragons anymore. Right. And so it's like there's this inevitability of doom that is like creeping into all these events.
Yeah,
that I think is very, very powerful. So,
and I think it's Daemon who points out, either in this Black Council scene or another one, that like dragons are pretty hard to kill if you're a person. They're not very hard to kill if you're a dragon. Like, dragons can kill each other.
You can have like 3 battles and then all the dragons are dead. Like, that's a thing that could happen, right? So,
and we see the fallout
of that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
As we saw this episode. Yeah.
And especially because the varying sizes and maturity of them matters, right? Too. That's why when Rhaenyra kind of pushes back against this using the dragon idea, she says, like, our dragons have never been to war. It's like putting a pony in a battlefield while there are like decades long experienced war horses stomping about and knowing exactly what to do underneath their rider. And again, we see that she was right to have been worried about that when Aemon and Luke come face to face on Dragonback.
A lot more thoughts on season 1, episode 10 of House of the Dragon. We will take a quick break and we'll be right back. So Daemon is really for going to war. Rhaenyra is not. Rhaenyra is being very sensible. She asks everyone to leave the room, and then she tells Daemon about the prophecy. And at that point, Daemon gets really upset and starts choking her for a really long time. I think he's upset for many, many reasons, right? There's a question of like, what is he upset by? Like, explicitly, he's upset that, like, Viserys was always into these dreams and prophecies, and he was never that kind of person. And like, maybe like on some level, he doesn't want that kind of stuff holding him back from taking sensible action. But he's also upset because he was never told the prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kim, during our weekly Twitter space last night, we talked mm-hmm. about the prophecy, and I was saying how, like, I can't believe they're putting so much on the prophecy, you know, like, because this is a prophecy that we know basically doesn't come true in Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
So why are they pinning so much on this prophecy? And Tyler over at Decoding TV wrote the following in response to that last night on at decodingtv.com. Tyler writes, quote, "I kind of disagree with David's argument against the prophecy. I don't think it matters at all that we know it doesn't come true, because none of the characters in the show have any reason to think it won't. I'll just pause here and say, I think it's weird if all the characters are saying the prophecy, the prophecy, the prophecy, we have to do the prophecy, and we as the audience know it doesn't happen. That's just like dramatically not super interesting. Much more interesting if we know the prophecy actually happens, because then they're like working towards something, in my opinion. I don't know.
Yeah,
people differ.
To briefly touch upon Rings of Power, which we have not done, obviously, because you have a whole other great Decoding TV podcast for that. But like, to me, the tension of like Galadriel knowing that, like, believing so deeply that Sauron is going to come back and knowing that she's right was like much more interesting than watching a lot of characters in this show insist that there's this prophecy that needs to happen and knowing that they're kind of wrong. Like,
yes,
they're not entirely wrong, but they're wrong enough.
They're wrong-ish.
Yeah. And I'm just like, there are so many other good arguments to be made for why Rhaenyra should be the rightful queen. Like her temperament, her age, her preparation for it.
Right.
Like all this stuff that they don't really focus on as much as they focus on her drive to fulfill or to live up to her father's wishes by really fulfilling this prophecy, as opposed to it just being like, my father taught me how to be a good ruler and now I'm trying to do that type of thing.
But Tyler continues, the main issue is that Rhaenyra and Aegon are both Targaryen, and as such, the prophecy does not favor one or the other being ruler. The second issue is I don't understand why it has to be a secret. It basically says a Targaryen needs to be in charge. Why keep that a secret from everyone? Are we supposed to believe that without this being secretive, that the Targaryens would have just given up and abdicated the throne? It seems to only exist as a device to excuse Alicent's decision to crown her son, end quote. What do you think of those issues of the prophecy?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that by, right, like, exactly right, that Aegon is also a Targaryen. So, like, Rhaenyra isn't panicking because there's about to be no Targaryen on the throne, and that's what needs to happen. Instead, it's like, it's more the fine print of the prophecy, which is like,
which is Rhaenyra was supposed to be the one, right? Like, according to Viserys.
I was going to say the fine print, meaning you have to hold the realm together. Mm. And I think that she knows that Aegon is not. Aegon and Otto combined, like everything that the Greens are doing is not actually in the best interest of the realm. It's just in the best interest of a patriarchal realm. So, yeah, I agree that they could have done a little bit of a better job explaining that it doesn't all just hinge on this like Targaryen secret blood right thing, but that it's like an issue of, we know that there is some threat coming. We can't afford to have a sex pest on the throne right now.
Right, right. Fair enough. Because that, you know, they would never be able to fight the White Walkers that way.
Mm-hmm.
So before we move on, like, do you have any thoughts on the whole Daemon choking Rhaenyra scene? I think, you know, to just briefly reiterate, like, my issue was that, like, how out of character is this for Daemon? Because this does match the character that we spent the first 5 episodes of the show getting to know, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you told me this Daemon from the first 5 episodes, like, choked his wife, I'd be like, yes, that fits in exactly with what I know about Daemon. It has not been with the version that we see in episodes 6 through 9. And so I'm just like, okay, I don't really know how I'm supposed to feel about this. But what did you think?
I mean, it didn't land shocking to me. It was it was upsetting to see that happen to Rhaenyra after everything that she just endured for the last 30 minutes of the episode. I mean, look, last time we saw Daemon, he sliced a dude's head off before anybody could even register that he was a threat in that room. You know, like, Daemon has still been doing these sort of like very bold, very aggressive, very violent moves in public. So it didn't really surprise me that he can act that way in private as well. And I also, like, I really bought into, or not bought into, I perceived something happening with Matt Smith's performance in this episode where I felt like Daemon was on the edge the whole time, even when he bent the knee. You know, he's on the whole face off with Otto. He's like, you can see him physically itching to pull out his sword and kill someone. Like, he's so frustrated by the talking and the talking and the talking. And yet Rhaenyra is queen. She gets to just do talking if she wants to do that. She gets to tell her advisors what to do if she wants to. And Daemon's been like, throughout this, up until this point, he's been sort of like testing the boundaries of how much he can assert his own power in the Black Council. I clocked, like, you know, when he's counting up the dragons and he just includes Melly's without even asking Rhaenys, like, hey, by the way, is your dragon on our cause? Like, he's making a lot of assumptions about how he wants the start of this fight to go. And so for Rhaenyra to like clear the room because he just yelled at her in front of the council, like, she clears the room, is like, okay, let's talk one-on-one. And then the first thing that she says is like this revelation to Daemon that his brother, who he always cared about, always wanted attention and love from, never considered him to be a serious enough contender for succession to tell him this prophecy. In the pilot episode, Daemon was the heir.
Yeah.
Like, everybody in King's Landing was under the assumption that if Viserys never had a son, that the throne would pass to to Daemon.
Yeah.
And so the fact that Viserys never had this serious conversation with him about this prophecy means that he never, at least before he named Rhaenyra heir, never fully intended for Daemon to assume that position. And I think that that is, like, on top of losing a baby with Rhaenyra in this episode, right? On top of the reminder of everything that he went through with Laena, on top of believing that his brother was killed, it was like one thing too many and he snapped. And like, I thought that was believable for his character in the moment. But again, everything that I just said is a ton of subtext happening that I was absorbing and making conclusions based off of, not a ton of like explicit previous demonstrations of how he behaves in private with Rhaenyra, if this is something that he's done before. I mean, and also the, I guess the last thing I'll say is like, Daemon and Rhaenyra's relationship started out as abusive. It just wasn't physically abusive.
Right.
It was very emotionally abusive. Like,
sure, sure.
He all the hallmarks of grooming were present in that episode 4 of like him, you know, getting her attention by giving her gifts, giving her wine, treating her like an adult in the room when everybody else was treating her like a child, like taking her out of her place of protection in the castle and into the city so that he was the only person she could rely upon for like protection, and then doing what he did in that brothel room by leaving her all vulnerable. Like, that was a huge, messy, very complex, layered way that they started their romantic and sexual relationship that was not healthy. And so to see them now as adults and be like, oh, that abuse has now escalated into potentially being physical whenever he is triggered enough, felt in line with me. But I also agree with the points that you made and that other people have said, which is that because of all of these time jumps, we really haven't gotten like a deeper understanding of the way that Daemon acts in private. Most of his scenes have been very public shows of power. Yeah. Right?
A really good comparison, I think, would be the Jaime storyline in Game of Thrones, which is like he starts out as a Game of Thrones as a raging asshole. Jaime Lannister, who's like basically a child murderer, you know, incestuous child murderer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is kind of what we know about him. And then slowly over the course of many, many, many years, he mellows out, right?
Yeah.
And we get to see that kind of take place over the course of many years. And here it feels like they fast forwarded through a bunch of that. So like, it just doesn't feel quite the same when he lashes out as he does in this episode. Anyway.
Yeah. I know.
We have a lot more we got to cover in the next like 20 minutes. So like, I just want to move on. So Corlys and Rhaenys. Corlys is alive and he's healthy and doing well. By the way, I love a good person walking into a throne room or hall scene.
Mm.
And House of the Dragon had a ton of them this season. And, and there was a bunch of this episode. There was like Rhaenyra walking into the hall at Dragonstone with all the Kingsguard behind her. That was cool. And then Corlys coming in with his cane. You know, just love a good walking into that hall scene, you know? So love that stuff. Anyway.
It was great.
So Corlys and Rhaenys, they talk about like all the stuff that's happened. Rhaenys fills them in all the stuff that's happened. And Vaemond's dead, and you know Rhaenyra is now sitting on the crown, and like we need to decide as a family like what we're going to do. And Corlys is like, let's just retire, like, you know, no one's gonna come after us. And she's like, you are wrong. We need to take a side. All right, the recording program I use has had lots of problems over the course of the last few weeks, and it just crashed in the middle of the recording. So if we sound or look different than we did just seconds ago, that is why. I believe we were just talking about Corlys and Rhaenys. She tells Corlys all the news that's happened. Vaemond's dead. Rhaenyra is part of the throne, like has ascended the throne. We need to pick a side. And if we don't, our children will always be in danger. You cannot just retire and go be, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. So there is this scene, there's this moment that like, Corlys says, oh, Rhaenyra is like the girl who ruins everything. And Rhaenys says, actually, she's the one holding everything together right now. And for me, this actually summarizes like the issue with the show, which is in my, you know, I think we disagree on this, but in my estimation, like a lot of the stuff she did in earlier episodes, there is a scene where she's talking with Laenor and Laenor is like, I should have been there. And she's like, that should be our house motto. It's like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, like they are like F-ups to some degree. And
yeah.
And then, and now she's like, all of a sudden she's like super responsible and really impressive. And I love this new Rhaenyra, but like, I do think like that's kind of the two versions of Rhaenyra we've been given in the show. Mm-hmm. So I actually didn't think either of them were wrong. They were both right in their own ways. But I know you and I differ about that.
Well, and I think that it's notable that Rhaenys has been our witness for like the last 72 hours of events in Westeros, right?
Right.
Like she was there. She watched what Alicent and Otto and Aegon were doing. And then she got to Dragonstone and took her time and watched to see what Rhaenyra was doing and has come to the conclusion that like Rhaenyra is the one that we should back. And so, yeah, you're kind of having to buy into the idea that Rhaenys is like an arbiter of judgment in a way that not everybody else who's making these loyalty calls is.
I did like that earlier on when Daemon calls her out for not murdering everyone, you know, in last episode. So that was a discussion we've had, obviously. And she says, it was not my war to start. And Rhaenys has been like really cool as a cucumber this whole time. She's like, I'm just going to wait and see how things play out. And I really admire like the methodical. It's methodical because once she declares something, she like generally follows that path. I don't think she's like treacherous in any way.
Yeah.
But she is going to wait until all the stuff works itself out before she like makes any definitive decisions. Corlys goes into the throne room and he declares that he's going to be on Rhaenyra's side. I didn't know if you felt like there was any explanation for why this was the case. My sense was just that Corlys thought it was most strategically useful or advantageous for that to happen. But I don't know if you had any opinion on like why it is Corlys decides to throw in with Rhaenyra versus taking his ships and going to King's Landing.
I chalked it up to him respecting her as a strategist and a leader in this moment. You don't have to like someone to follow your oath to them, right? And he did indeed bend the knee and swear obeisance that Rhaenyra would be the true heir. And so I think that we're seeing him overcome whatever emotional feelings he might have about Rhaenyra's behavior and like just register that she is indeed the stronger, the more rightful ruler in this case. I also clocked like he asks where Daemon is, and when Rhaenyra says like, oh, he's off doing something else, he like gives her this look. And again, when I was rewatching this weekend, in the pilot episode, Corlys is there when the whole conversation happens between Viserys and Otto and Lord Beesbury about like what Daemon is doing, because he's not at the small council table where he theoretically should be. He's off with his gold cloaks. And Viserys kind of like makes this comment about like, if he's distracted, that means that we've achieved our goal. And I think that Corlys, right in that moment, sees Rhaenyra doing kind of the same thing of like, oh, the last time we saw Rhaenyra and Daemon alone, he was physically abusing her. Now he's not in that small council room anymore. He's off doing his dragon activities. And I think Corlys is like, oh, Rhaenyra knows that Daemon sometimes needs to be like handled. And I watched Viserys do it, and now I'm watching his daughter do it. And like, I'm going to be there to back her up in the same way that I think he wanted to be a solid small council member to Viserys.
Yeah. Anything else from this scene where Corlys swears his obedience that you want to mention?
There was just a neat, when he explains like that he has in fact like left a garrison at the Stepstones and is prepared to like to still control that area. It's basically the inverse of what he was doing for Viserys. So like when he explained in earlier in the season that the Stepstones were an issue, he was saying like, if you can throttle trade from Essos into King's Landing, like you will beggar the realm. And now he's on the other side of it. There's a new king in King's Landing that he wants out of there. And so now he gets to be the one who beggars the realm by closing all of those trade ports. And so just good payoff for like why the triarchy thing was such a like a big storyline in the start of the season. I kept kind of being like, wow, they're really bringing up these Stepstone things all the time. And it's like, oh, here's the payoff, is that the strategy that Rhaenyra suggested in episode 6 of like, we should have had a garrison there, we should have controlled it so that the triarchy couldn't emerge again. Corlys has now done that, and it's only to Rhaenyra's benefit. So just a nice little like coming together of the fact that they are of the same strategic mind.
Rhaenyra says she wants to figure out who's on her side. She wants to make sure, you know, send out ravens, send out notes, send out messengers, and try to see like where everyone stands, right? And her sons volunteer. They're like, we should take dragons because dragons are faster than ravens. and also dragons are more persuasive. And so after some significant deliberation, she has a moment where she's like, I got to think about this. But then she's like, you're right. That may, you know, I think Corlys is like, this is makes sense. You should do this. So she agrees to it. So, yep, go ahead.
Which, again, is the same thing that happened in episode two when the issue came up at the small council table that Daemon had stolen this egg. And Rhaenyra was the one to suggest, like, father, you have dragon rider, send me. And she was right in that case. And Corlys backed her up in that case back when she was a girl. And so... Yeah. I think that we're watching her have to allow her own children to make that call and not belittle them or diminish them in front of the small council, but instead embolden them and like give them that confidence of like, yeah, when I was your age, I also had strategy ideas that sometimes worked out or that my father wouldn't listen to that frustrated me. Now she's listening to her sons when they say like, I think this is a good idea. I think that I should be a part of this. And she's letting them, which Viserys didn't when she was that age. Or she did it anyways without his permission. But, you know, he chastised her for it. And he was kind of right. They're both right. Look what happens. You lose an heir. Like, it's a huge risk. I understood why Rhaenyra was open to it in that moment because of what we saw from her in earlier episodes.
It is cool. Like, again, in praise of the time jumps, it is pretty satisfying to get these kind of parallel scenes within the span of one season, right?
Like, yeah.
Not saying it couldn't have been done better otherwise, but like, it is cool. Yeah, we see you shouldn't take a dragon there as a messenger, you know? Meeting on the bridge, like all these other things that happened. So
it at least signals that there was, in the writer's room, there was a logic behind it, right? That they were trying to stay consistent with these parallels and themes, not just doing time jumps for reasons
to like cram in. Yeah, there was like a thematic reason for it. Yeah, so there's a scene with Rhaenyra and Luke and Jace where she kind of gives them the messages and she's like, here you go, you know. She's sending them off to different places. Where is she sending them off to, Kim?
So she's sending Luke, her youngest, or the youngest of the two, to Storm's End, which isn't too far. She says like it's a short flight. It's like
it's a hop, skip, and a jump. A
couple bays away, you know?
Yeah.
It's the SFO to LAX flight as opposed to, like, she's kind of sending Jace on the LAX to JFK flight a little bit farther because Jace is headed to Winterfell and the Eyrie. But we don't see Jace for the rest of this episode, so that's going to be saved for season two, apparently. Yay, Winterfell! Mm. We're going back to Winterfell.
Yeah, I was a little bit bummed we didn't see any Winterfell, I think, this season at all, if I recall correctly, right?
Yeah. No, just some Starks. But, yeah, so.
So the dragons fly off, and then at that time, Daemon goes to visit a massive dragon called Vermithor.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the dragon that was ridden by King Jaehaerys, who is the king that we saw in the opening scene of this series, right?
Yes.
So what are some, you had some cool observations about this scene, including the fact that like the language that Daemon was singing in and what he was saying, right?
Yeah. So he's singing in High Valyrian. In the episode, I didn't get, there weren't subtitles, right? Were there subtitles?
I don't recall there being subtitles. Yeah.
No, but, I follow David J. Peterson, who is the language expert. He's the one who created the actual like Dothraki and Valyrian language that you hear in the show. Because in the books, obviously, like George just says, and then they were speaking in Dothraki. Like there are like some words, but not whole sentences. So he actually has a website where he posted an English translation of the song. He said it was created for the show. So this isn't a song from Fire and Blood. It was created for the show by himself and T. Mickle, who is one of the story consultants on the show. She's in the credits very frequently. She was sort of there from the beginning working with George R. R. Martin and Ryan Condal to kind of develop what the overall story should be. And yeah, I can... do you want me to read the whole English translation?
Sure. Hit us.
Okay. The song says, "Fire breather, winged leader, but two heads to a third sing. From my voice, the fires have spoken, and the price has been paid with blood magic, with words of flame, with clear eyes, to bind the three, to you I sing. As one we gather, and with three heads, we shall fly as we were destined, beautifully, freely." It's a nice song.
Yeah, very nicely done, Kim Renfro. That is what Daemon is singing to Vermithor in this episode of House of the Dragon. So... So ultimately, Kim, any thoughts on the purpose of this scene? I think it's just an ominous sign of the Dragon Wars to come. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was nice, given that Daemon just like listed off a bunch of dragons and he mentions Vermithor, that then we actually see Vermithor. Vermithor is very old. He's supposed to be about 100 years old at this point. So I think, again, we're getting a glimpse at the scale of dragons. We see later that obviously Aemond riding Vhagar is like the biggest, most baddest ass dragon of all. Vermithor would be pretty much up there if he had a rider. And so I think that it's hinting at the fact that here's a dragon without a rider who seems closer to being able to match up against Vhagar as opposed to Arrax, who is only a few years old. I think maybe like a little over 10 years old. And so, yeah, just more dragon lore. Also just showing us again that Daemon is, of all the Targaryens, Daemon is like the horse master or the nuclear master. Weapon master.
He controls the nuclear football yeah. in the world of Westeros, right?
Yeah, so. Like the end of the episode brings up so much about bonds with dragons, control over dragons, and I think that we're just seeing that Daemon has really studied and mastered the art of dragon relationships more than any other Targaryen that we're seeing in the show so far.
All right. Luke and Jace go to Storm's End. There is a pretty great scene Luke and Aemond go to Storm's End. We don't see Aemond there, but he's already there when he arrives. I loved this whole sequence. Like, in general, I thought it was really well done. Boros Baratheon is there, and Aemond has already approached him with a pretty good offer. And that offer is what again, Kim Renfro?
Basically, I will wed one of your four daughters, which Tyland Lannister brought that up in the Green Council scene in episode 9 of being like, Storm's End is of concern, but there are four, he has four daughters and none of them are wed yet. And so they kind of set up the fact that, yes, it is a good political strategy for Aemond to show up there and be like, hey, I'll take one of your daughters and then she'll become a princess and get to live in King's Landing and like raise the station of your home.
Right, right. Whereas Luke doesn't have anything. He comes empty-handed. Boros Baratheon's pretty pissed about this and kind of sends him on his way. But before he can go, Aemond tries to start some stuff. You know, he says, like, hey, I'm not going to let you go. You need to, like, take out your own eye. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it, but you need to do it. It's like, okay, Aemond, do you really think he's going to do it, Aemond? Come on. So anyway, Luke flees. Boros is like, I'm not having this under my roof, which is very smart of him.
And it shows that Rhaenyra's strategy was correct. By asserting himself as a messenger in that room, it's like the guest right thing that we saw go horribly wrong with the Red Wedding. Like, there are many lords in Westeros who like very much believe in the rituals and rites and protections of the faith. And so by having Luke go there purely as a messenger, it obligates Boros to protect him in some way under his own roof. And so Rhaenyra's strategy held. It just didn't hold because she didn't anticipate the outside potential of danger.
Yeah, come on, Boros. You couldn't have given Luke like maybe a
head start.
A head start, like a one-hour head start. I really loved like a lot of things about the sequence. First of all, there is this moment when Luke gets off and he's just getting into the throne room. And you see a dragon in the distance. That's amazing because it's just so ominous. It's like, wait, why is there already a dragon here? Like, what is the explanation there? And of course, it's not only like it's a ominous portent of like what is going to happen to Luke, but also the fact that Aemond's already there, right?
Yeah.
Then he's like running back to his car in the rain, which is what we all hate to do, trying to get the keys into the thing. And, you know, it's tough. It's tough. And he takes off and there are just so many great shots here, some of which are borrowed directly from the DreamWorks animated film How to Train Your Dragon, where you have this like enormous dragon facing off against this tiny dragon in front of it. I should do like a shot for shot comparison because there's like,
you totally should
on Twitter or something, because there's some shots that are like literally like, well, there's a shot I think with like the gigantic dragon like chasing after the small dragon, and you see them like the size next to each other, and that's like straight from How to Train Your Dragon 1.
Great movies.
But I thought this whole thing was really great. And there's this moment when he goes like above the clouds and it's like beautiful and brilliant. You know, the whole sequence I thought was really good. But of course, Kim Renfro, there's a big change from the books, which is that in the books, it's theoretically more intentional.
Yeah.
What Aemond does to kill Luke. In here, both Aemond and Luke lose control of their dragons. Luke's dragon kind of, needles Aemond's dragon a little bit.
Tries
to attack. And then Aemond's dragon gets so pissed that it chomps Luke's dragon in half, presumably killing both of them. So this is a pretty big change as far as I can tell. But Kim, your thoughts on how the Luke Aemond stuff wrapped up this episode?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of shifts the culpability of Luke's death slightly away from Aemond. I mean, I think that he's still responsible for having gotten on his massive dragon back and chased. Like, even him trying to just chase or scare Luke would have been, I don't know. I think that they've reduced him a little bit from being, like, cartoonishly villainous. Like, he has, like, a cackle in this scene when he's, like, on Vhagar's back that was, like, you know, classic villain laugh. But then to add a little bit of depth to the situation by having Aemond not realize that Vhagar will do things of her own accord, and or, like, I kind of was rewatching it wondering if they are getting at, like, there's a difference between a writer's emotional state and the commands that they're shouting. Like, I think I saw someone point this out on Twitter, but, like, Arax can probably feel that Luke is scared in the same way that during Rhaenyra's childbirth at the start of the episode, we're getting these flashes of Syrax as she's in pain, almost as if, like, Syrax can sense that there's something going on with his rider. Right.
And there's an implication in the books that they're, like, telepathically linked somehow.
Yeah, right? Totally. And, like, we saw this with Dany. I mean, even the way that Daemon can, like, summon Caraxes without really saying anything, but, like, Caraxes shows up exactly whenever Daemon wants him to for, like, an intimidation standoff or whatever. So, like, I don't think it's a stretch to think that, like, Vhagar can tell that Aemond hates this kid and wants to hurt him, maybe if not kill him, but, like, wants to hurt him, and they're chasing him. And then, like, Arax can probably tell that Luke is scared and needs defending or, like, something. And so it just, I like, to your point at the start of the episode, I think that this was a really good example of the way that escalation of violence can happen, whether you intended it to or not, but just by the situation that you've put yourself in, or by the lack of communication that you're offering to the other person. Like, the fact that Aemond still cannot let go of this fight that they had when they were children, and he's trying to, like, use schoolyard bullying tactics, but on the back of the biggest and most ancient and most battle-experienced dragon that is alive in the world right now. Like, that's not a power to be trifled with, and I think Aemond learned a very big lesson, as opposed to them deciding to have Aemond already be some sort of, like, sociopathic murderer dude who's just, like, killing kids the first chance he can.
Right. I agree. It does make it more interesting that it was preventable, basically, right?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like it removes this kind of, there's an inevitability that conflict will happen, but there's also this idea that, like, hey, if Aemond just didn't F around, maybe none of this would have happened. Like, maybe the conflicts to come wouldn't have happened. And so,
yeah. If Aemond didn't fuck around, Rhaenyra might have been able to pull off a siege with all of her allies and stuff. But the fact that this death happens is what moves Rhaenyra from resisting all-out war to being like, all right, like, great, let's just fucking do this, is basically the final shot of the scene or of the episode.
There have been a lot of questions as to how Daemon learned about what actually happened. Right? We've gotten some emails at castkings@gmail.com, a lot of people tweeting, people being wondering, like, how did Daemon find out? In the books, the pieces of the body of Luke and also the dragon washed up on shore at Storm's End. Is that correct, Kim?
It says that Arax, it says that the dragon, like a dragon wing or like parts of a dragon were, like, surfaced in the bay of Storm's End. It says that Luke's body was never found. I was rewatching it, like, Vhagar really does kind of chomp right where Luke is. Like, she might have eaten Luke, and then just the pieces of the dragon that were left fell to the ground. But I think that you're supposed to assume that some time has passed. There's, like, a little scroll in Daemon's hand when he approaches Rhaenyra, and you're just supposed to assume that like Syrax's body has been found. It's a short distance away, so Luke obviously hasn't returned
yet. It's supposed to be a day trip, and then it's been like a week, and he hasn't come back. And so then they get the scroll, and that is a very awesome piece of acting at the very end,
From Emma Darcy.
Where Rhaenyra turns. Yeah, it's Emma Darcy turns around, and you know, it's, I think it all is done in one long shot, if I recall correctly, where
it
like
is,
in slow motion, and like they go again, another walking into the hall scene that I love, and she turns around, and you see she's received the news, and she knows what she has to do, and it's a great, it's like a great piece of acting, a great place to end the season, a kind of chilling place to end the season. I really liked it. Any thoughts on this final sequence, Kim Renfro?
I just loved it too. Again, Emma Darcy has such a physicality to their performance as Rhaenyra. And so not getting to see their face as the news is processed, but instead just see like slumped shoulders, slight staggered walk, and then like stealing, like the way that Rhaenyra is like stealing herself for what she now knows she has to do, which is be the Black Queen and like win this war at any cost. Like now there's blood. Now there's family blood on the line, not just the realm. So
yeah, it's in slow motion too. And this is a weird thing for me to say, but it's hard to act in slow motion, like because it means basically you need to like make the change like much quicker, because we're seeing it take place in, you know, 10 seconds on screen. It actually took 5 seconds of her time in real life. You know, it's a very subtle, nuanced, excellent moment to end the season on. And also, speaking of parallels, kind of very similar to the shot at the end of episode one, where Rhaenyra kind of looks at the camera as everyone's swearing fealty to her.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's a different situation where Rhaenyra is looking at the camera, but she's going off to war. So anyway, a lot of great stuff.
Yeah.
That is our conversation about the episode, but it is not the end of our conversation about House of the Dragon season one, because Kim Renfro and I will be recording at least one more bonus episode to take place sometime in the course of the next week. So look out for it. But until then, you can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com. Email us. Let us know what you thought of the season of the episode at acastofkings@gmail.com. We're going to be talking about your emails and feedback on next week's episode. And also find us on Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube at acastofkings. Thank you so much to everyone who has joined us this season. I think this is like going to be the end for a lot of people. There's, you know, from what I've seen, there's going to be a lot of people listening to the bonus episode too, but there's definitely going to be a drop off. So this is probably going to be the final episode that most of the people listening right now are going to hear. So Kim, any closing thoughts?
No, thank you so much to every single person who has commented, tweeted, Instagrammed, TikToked with us throughout this season. David Chen makes great care to send me the nice things that people say about me, and it has always warmed my heart. So if you have ever reached out, or if you've ever just sent positive vibes our way, it's so appreciated, and we're here because of all of you. So thank you for being here with us.
Indeed. I also want to say a big thank you to everyone who's listened this season. I know it was a big casting change to have a new crew on A Cast of Kings, but you know some institutions like to do a casting change, like ease people into it, you know, tell people exactly what the new dynamics are, and some people just slam you right into it. I'm not sure who I'm talking about, obviously, but I hope you've been eased into it, and I know for a fact that there are thousands of more Kim Renfro fans today than there were than when we started this thing. And that means that this thing was a success to me. So
thank you.
All right. That's it for the season. For those who are sticking around for the bonus episode next week, we will talk to you then. But until next week, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you later.
Bye.